Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshinworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO and founder of Shoshinworks, and today I'm joined by my co-host, James Villarubia. James, welcome.
Thank you, Diane. It is always a pleasure to be here. And for the new listeners out there, my name is James Villarubia. I'm a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I focus on helping the engineers and the scientists at NASA integrate AI and into their knowledge management, how they do research and science, hopefully better and faster than they did before. So really great to be here. Before joining NASA, I had a career in a lot of social impact, public policy spaces in both DC and New York, and just super excited to have our guest here today, Miss Katie Meyer. She is a former classmate and colleague of mine going way back. And Katie, I think as our listeners will find out, is very sharp. I've been following her career for many years and always a little envy, a little jealousy. It's like, oh man, she's working on such cool stuff. So I think you're in for a real treat. For a quick sample, I mean, Katie, she had a long career in the House of Representatives as a senior policy advisor, even as a House leader, Kevin McCarthy, for a while on Senate Finance Committee, health policy advisor, and then sort of recently, several years ago, came over to a company, Novocure, and she is now the vice president of government affairs for Novocure. So if you are in the health or medical device space, Katie is certainly behind the scenes working to make sure that things are moving smoothly and we are innovating for the next systemic future of healthcare. So enough about me, and I will just hand us over to the wonderful person herself. Katie, welcome to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit better than I did, of course.
Hi, James. Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for having me join. I'm really, really glad to be invited and tickled, James, to be told that you've envied my career when you're the guy working at NASA. So that's nice. Really pleased to be on the show today. James, you did a good job introducing me. I would only add, after over a decade on Capitol Hill, where worked on healthcare policy, trade policy, small business, education, so issues across the gamut, which is typical for a Capitol Hill staffer, joined Novocure 3.5 years ago to start the government affairs team at that company, and now lead our market access, patient advocacy, charitable giving, and a few other of the departments for Novocure. And the company makes a medical device that treats cancer, a brand new way of treating cancer with the electrical properties of dividing cells. So it's been quite an adventure. And again, thrilled to be here. Thank you.
So thrilled to have you, Katie. And really, the work that you're doing is just amazing. And maybe if you can walk us through some of your perspective regarding how innovation meets up with policy and governance and in a way that extends the reach and benefit.
Absolutely. Yeah, what a great question. So I think this is a story of incentives. It's so important to understand how much the people who are investing their time and energy in innovation are affected by the incentives that are set up. And in a space like healthcare that's so tightly regulated, those incentives set by the government are, I think, probably the most important set of incentives. And that is true when it comes to how a company is able to get investment because the investors are looking at potential markets. It comes through with the regulators, with the payers. That's a space I've focused on quite a lot, especially with the Medicare and Medicaid programs. Innovators are really reactive to the policies that are set up. So when the government says, hey, we'll put more money into this space, you see those changes in behavior really happening in a pretty dynamic fashion. I would say one example of this is when the Medicare program was started, we had a real rush, I think, to start spending more of society's resources on healthcare innovation. And that's an interesting story that has played out over the last 60 years, and glad to talk more about that.
It's a great point. Do we now maybe face a potential renaissance, right, in or the next generation of that kind of that story in that's being ushered in by AI, right? Can data and technology really amplify our opportunity to make better decisions in the way we design and distribute incentives, right, for greater?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, you're seeing a lot of healthcare companies doing really interesting things with AI around identifying drug compounds that might work for things that they hadn't previously been identified for, or using AI other ways in the drug development process. I've seen less of that in devices, but I think it's coming. I think there's a lot of, frankly, a lot of fear also around the use of AI in healthcare, and I'm not sure that's completely unwarranted. There's a lot of opportunity there. You see some where physicians are worried about being crowded out, but then also people who are afraid of what impact AI could have on their healthcare if it's not done in an ethical and careful way. So that may be a place that we want to look more into the right incentives too. And a lot of folks are talking about that, but I'm not sure what the answers are necessarily in the AI space quite yet.
So it seems like even with AI, I mean, that's, I think, a topic that is rapidly changing today, and people appreciate the speed with which the world is being disrupted by AI. But it feels like the medical space has also, like, it has been rapid for a long time, that there has been a lot of changes and a lot of innovation moving at a pace like AI, at a pace that maybe is faster than our ability to regulate it thoughtfully or effectively. And that sort of changes some of the incentives. I mean, great. Well, if we move fast enough, the regulations won't apply, which is can lead to other issues. But at the same time, like, well, if the regulations are too strict, then we don't get the pace. We don't actually get to see some of the advancements. I mean, how do you think about the right speed or the right relationship, even how you convey those risks to non-physicians and non-technologists on the Hill or in the policy space and say, hey, this is maybe the right framework to think about it, even if you don't understand the science that, you know, or the bucket of science that we're talking about?
Yeah, James, what a great question. So I think as a government affairs professional today, one of the most compelling ways to communicate the impact of policies is to bring it all the way to the patient level, right? And what impact could this policy have on the person who is receiving healthcare? And I'm in the fortunate position of working for a company that has innovated a new way of treating cancer, right? So it's a really great story to tell. I'm able to bring patients who have benefited from our technology to meet with legislators and have them help tell that story, right? What happens if the Medicare program changes its payment for this type of technology? Well, maybe people won't have access to it anymore, right? Or in the other direction, maybe we can help usher in a lot more innovation in this space. So I think that is a way that legislators across the political spectrum do really react well to those types of messages, and it motivates them. You've got, of course, folks who are concerned about costs of products, right? I think that's one of the biggest things we've been hearing about in the healthcare space is kind of the idea of balancing innovation with affordability and access. Those are tough questions without easy answers. And I think we kind of swing from one way to the other, right? There's been a swing recently to how do we control costs in the healthcare system, which I think could have a negative impact on innovation. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the next few years in particular.
I wanted to sort of follow up on that. I love this idea of, I mean, I'm imagining the patients like lined up to like walking around the Hill, having spent some time there, a small crowd of patients going door to door.
Yeah, exactly.
Preaching the good news of various technology or policy. I think it's great for both legislators and patients and citizens to sort of have that experience. One of the things that we, I think, struggle with at NASA, as broadly within the group with that sort of sponsors this podcast, is thinking about long-term futures. And I just want to think about, like, does that sort of reliance on it's a patient, it's a person, if that is an effective policy mechanism to, like, get things and convey it, like, how do we fight for the things that are a little bit more esoteric or deep tech or farther along? Hey, the person who might benefit from this will be born in 20 years. And does that exist now? Or it's a medical issue that is like light, but, you know, impacts hundreds of millions, not like severe and 10,000. I mean, we struggle with that sort of thinking about how we invest. I just would love to hear your thoughts on sort of how the healthcare industry is dealing with that complexity of that balance of early and late early and late research. And so one key point is, I think some of the early mRNA research that sponsored that and ended up producing the COVID vaccines was in its early days, like, oh, that's never going to go anywhere. And it was sort of like, thankfully, there was a couple, like three or four researchers who were like, nope, we're going to keep doing this. We think there's a there. But it wasn't necessarily from like a popularity. They weren't winning popularity contests from like a research perspective at the time. But now, of course, we see the benefit. How do you find that? Have you seen some other examples of good and bad mistakes we've made there?
Yeah, James, what an interesting question. I think it's hard to advocate for a policy and for Congress to care about it if there's not an immediate constituency, right? And I think that's probably what you're talking about at NASA as well. So yeah, how do we get legislators to focus on the incentives that will lead to innovations in the future is challenging, especially when you're a company, right? A public company that's focused on what are we going to talk about next quarter? So that's a challenge. I think I'm lucky to work at a company, and this does exist, that does think long term. What are we going to be able to deliver to patients in the next decade? And how do we continue to support that flywheel of innovation? But a lot of companies aren't able to do that. So there's the incidental research that happens in academia, right? Trade associations advocate for patient groups, although it's hard sometimes to see that also. And then government bodies, right? Like, I think the NIH, and Congress has continued to fund the NIH at a really high level. There's a great deal of bipartisan support for that early basic research that could lead to breakthroughs in healthcare and other areas of the economy being critically important. And there are key constituencies around that, right? So like, once a funding stream is created, it has its own constituencies and then it continues to exist. So I'm not too worried about the future of the NIH.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Yeah, I think people think NIH and they don't necessarily distinguish it from sort of like emerging right now tech versus like the long-term tech. I was like, well, actually, they are parts of the ecosystem, and you've got the NIH. You might not feel the pain this election cycle, but you will in 10, in 15, as prices increase or as things just don't pan out. We just don't have the innovation that we hope for.
You mentioned COVID vaccines and the early mRNA research, James, and I think that's a really good example of how the government incentives can create outcomes that are desirable. So yes, the mRNA research had been happening for a long time, but I think the fact that when COVID started, the US government made a commitment and said, if a company is able to develop a vaccine, we'll buy it. We'll buy as much as you've got, enough for the whole country and for other countries. That created a rush, right? When if the government hadn't stepped in to do that, you would hope that people would want a vaccine, but it's not guaranteed. So I think that's on a large scale, the kind of incentives that I'm talking about, where, you know, if you set up a Medicare program that says we're going to pay for all oncology drugs, that's how it is today, you'll see a renaissance and you'll see a lot of investment go into oncology drugs, which is what's happened. And how incredible has that been, right? We've seen a lot of these cancers go from quick killers to, in some cases, diseases that you can live with or even chronic diseases that can be managed. And that's just amazing, right? But there are other areas where we haven't done that. So there are diseases where you haven't seen that kind of investment. And in particular, pediatrics are really hard to get reimbursed for. So I think you see pediatrics being underinvested as one example of the way those payment systems have incentivized the different types of research.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that about the pediatrics, but to hit your point home on the I had a family member dealing with thyroid cancer, and it was a big scare to us. And then they were like, no, don't worry. Like, it's, this is
great. Right.
Of the cancer is like, yo, what, like, we'll schedule you in 2 weeks. Or like, I want an appointment tomorrow. They're like, no, we promise you're fine.
Yes.
You're going to be totally okay.
Yeah.
And like that, like their acknowledgement of that it was like so blasé about it. Like, oh no, we see this all the time. It's not a risk, was such a strange thing for us, like, but it's cancer. Like, what are you talking about? But it speaks to sort of like even sort of the mental shift of people thinking about like, oh, wow, we are at a point where some cancers are more chronic issues. Like, oh, we'll monitor it for a while. We will treat it if it gets to this point, but we know a lot and we can deal with a lot. So yeah, I think your point is very well taken. Diane, over to you. You were going to make a point. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to lean into the foresight and the futures literacy and building that into the system, right? So is there an opportunity for us, right? As innovators, is there an opportunity for us to align more of our communications and storytelling with the legislators, right? And now what I'm hearing too is maybe the constituents as well, right? Is there a larger role for storytelling to hold in the way we think about and address where investments are made, the kind of the modifications in the governance systems so that we do get maybe less of an underinvestment in pediatrics, right? Is there an opportunity for futures literacy to thread into the way we look at our portfolio of investments in both kind of innovation and policy in order to create more benefit, balanced benefit across society? So I know that's a rhetorical question and the answer is yes, but how can we systematically pull some of what's working in the work that, say, you guys are doing at NovaCure, right? And make that more of a systematic approach.
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. That's probably the $100 billion question. But I think in addition to pediatrics, when you think about cancer drugs, and I will make this a broader comment, but the drugs can do so many things, but there are areas of the body that a drug isn't effective. So when you think about especially brain cancers, pancreatic cancers, the parts of the body that a drug can't get to, blood-brain barrier, like the body protects the pancreas, so the drugs can't get, those are places where we haven't been as effective yet, right? So how do you incentivize different kinds of therapies? And again, I think it's about payment systems and about ensuring that there is that there's a market for something in the end is how you drive the innovation. And I think on a broader scale, when our company was really able to continue in those early days because of some private donors who believed in the idea, right? And they believed in the idea and thought it might pay off one day and were interested in it. And so those folks, they're not just deciding between different healthcare options. They're deciding about whether to invest in a healthcare options or like a financial services tool or a space company, right? And what type of new tech could have returns in the future. So I think it's obviously the ecosystem, there has to be in the ecosystem this early research that's funded by the government largely because it's so hard for a company to do that long term, but also something that can help motivate that long term thinking is, are we pretty sure that someone will pay for this and will the government pay for it one day? And I think that might be harder to do in the type of work that you're working in today, James, but I don't know. I'd be curious to see if can we think about how we'd incentivize more, I don't know, work in space or work in flight or what is that?
I mean, I think that we are where we maybe put maybe in the last 20 years or so, maybe took our foot off the gas pedal in a lot of aerospace industries. I think we are now seeing like, oh, well, maybe that was a mistake. I think what is the same Altman even said about AI is like, well, like I did OpenAI because the government didn't. And I think that sort of speaks to there are some opportunities for the big bleeding edge stuff. It doesn't necessarily need a billionaire. Would NASA have gotten to with greater risk tolerance and more funding, gotten to the sort of the reusable or redestroyable, depending on your view of sort of these capsules that the SpaceX approach has taken? Because you have to swallow a lot of pain to be like, yeah, I'm going to build 10 of something and I assume 9 are going to blow up is a very different perspective from a government institution. And I think that is approach sort of like how we view risk. But in aviation, we look at like, well, drones, like, Where are we on the drones, this drones issue? And now, like, it's a small commercial product, but we see in Ukraine, obviously drones are becoming a massive part of the defense infrastructure. So I think that the ecosystem is changing rapidly and we are, I think, smartly, it seems like the funding is picking up and saying, yo, we see it now. We get it. We are investing. But it does go back to your point. It's like, how can we incentivize this steady, because if there are disruptions in those incentives, 10-year bets suddenly become that are valuable. And so like your best bet is 5 years. How do you maintain funding over 10? One of the things you brought up, Katie, which I thought was sort of interesting, was this reference of the donors or investors. I guess, are you seeing from your perspective, and maybe even from your time on the Hill, competing interests from nonprofit sectors? I think it's sort of like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation saying, hey, here's where we think money should be going. Congress or other institutions saying, hey, we think the money should be going here. And companies maybe stuck in the middle, like, what? I've got to attract both. I've got to attract one. How do you view that as a sort of the fundraising capacity, of the support capacity? Like, I want champions. I don't necessarily, I don't know, maybe you do care, like, which side the champions come from. But I just want to know, like, what are your thoughts on sort of that interplay?
Yeah, I think when a company like NovaCure is starting out, it's going to take whatever resources it can get, right? I mean, I'm not
a fair enough, fair enough.
Yeah. Field, but when you talk about, you don't want it to be dilutive, and how can you make sure that you have control? I do think that there's fear sometimes, and it could be misplaced or not, about receiving government funding and what that might mean for IP protection in the future. I think that's increasing today in the healthcare space because of some of the conversations that the US government's been having and becoming more aggressive on merchant rights. We're going to take over your patent because you're not providing this product at a low enough price. So I do see some of that. But when you, yeah, an early company, we'll take it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time. So this the nature of the balance between the public and private sector seems to be evolving, right? And we seem to be seeing a lot of different successful models in play. We're observing and kind of participating in one arena, kind of the activation of in-space servicing, assembly, and manufacturing, which is you're pushing basically logistics, a layer of logistics up into orbit, if you will, which is kind of a long tech development cycle and a heavy lift from an uncertainty, a risk, and an investment perspective. But really, to your point, necessarily government is kind of customer number one in that journey. But then over time, you hope that you're vectoring in a way that you see more and more of the industry build up around that. And so there's kind of this dance that evolves over time. And I think that is one example. In healthcare, you have a lot of really brilliant developments and innovation in arenas that are going to take a long time to develop, right? So how do you get that balance right? So early on, you have, to your earlier point, Katie, government leading, right? Government is the lead investor and or the lead customer. And over time, you hope that industry kind of builds up around that, because you're solving for, back to your earlier point, those patient use cases and outcomes. A big part of that is storytelling, futures literacy, and making sure that you're anchored on the right target outcomes. But it's hard to get all of those pieces to kind of work together in concert as the markets mature. What are some of the tips and traps that you are finding as an organization for market maturation around emerging technologies?
I think in addition to, we've talked about it already a little bit, getting that balance right and allowing the private sector to come in requires, and this is a weird way to put it, but it's like rule of law, right? You see it in developed countries that companies are able to do this more effectively because they feel confident that the investments that they're making will be protected. And that's around IP rights. It's around like government takings. It's making those companies or their boards of directors or their investors feel confident that the investments the company's making are worthwhile, that they'll have a return. So it's we've talked earlier also about guaranteed markets. That's part of it, or probability of a good market. But there's also these other, I think, basic requirements needed to ensure that a business can operate and kind of pick up from where the government has started things. I'm going to pivot. I really love this idea where you're talking about narratives and the importance of narratives, because we talked earlier about patient stories. And I think that the ability to paint a picture of something in the future is so powerful. It affects legislators. When I worked on Capitol Hill, you would have people referencing fiction, right? The ideas that have been and then painted in a really beautiful way by people in arts, right? Arts and sciences and arts and culture. That affects the vision that legislators and the funders in the private sector, in the public sector, have for the what society could look like and where resources should be put. And I think I love the way you're talking about the value of narrative to shape that, because I've seen it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so powerful. But James, you were going to jump in here.
Yeah, no, I wanted the snaps for that comment. I think it's one of the things in AI we are dealing with actively, because we think about there are concerns around AI, concerns around even some healthcare and some patient data and security and privacy, sort of how our ecosystem changes with AI. But when people think about AI, the narrative that they go to is, oh, it's going to be Terminator. There's going to be robots coming for us. And I was like, no, it's going to be people in that chat room trying to convince you to buy something because they're pretending to be a really smart sounding sales rep or whatever for some non-existent company. So, I mean, we're already seeing that in sort of scam emails as this big uptick. So the narratives of sort of how people think about risks and reward and sort of like what is the future going to be absolutely do shape it. So I'm glad to see that is a universal benefit and concern across it. I do want to ask about sort of like NovaCure and your company sort of innovations, because we talked about government policy and incentives, but I do actually want to understand a little bit of like what you guys are working on. Like what are the cool things that you're building and where you see the industry going from like your segment of cancer research or whatever it may be in the next 10, 15 years?
Thank you for asking that. NovaCure is focused on, so our company was founded by a really brilliant scientist in Israel at the Technion Institute who is the world's leading expert on the electrical systems in the body. He invented the technology that allows physicians to map a patient's heart to figure out where to do the ablation when you have a cardiac arrhythmia. And he came up with this idea that cancer cells could be targeted with an electric field that would stop the mitosis process, because that process relies on electric properties of dividing cells. And it was just a nugget, right? It was just an idea. We think this could work. First, it was in the chalkboard in his shelter, and then petri dishes, and then started doing the live testing. And lo and behold, it works. We've proven it works for glioblastoma brain tumors. And the company is really focused on proving that this could work in other types of solid cancers. So in the immediate future, that is the real focus of the company, is can we demonstrate that this would be of benefit to patients? And because it's different than a chemotherapy where you're trying to poison the tumor, there are very few side effects to this therapy. So it's a really nice thing to add to the toolbox. I think longer term, I don't know. I think this company has a lot of really interesting big thinkers. I got to visit the shop in Israel a couple of years ago. I'm so lucky I was able to do that prior to what's happened now. And there's a machine shop, and there's like actual tools to prototype. And then we've got engineers and physicists and electronics experts, and they're just all sitting there talking about how do we use these types of tools to help people live longer and better lives. So I'm excited for the other applications that could come out of this, but really today the company's focused on treating cancer. But it's all about those incentives. What do we think we might be able to accomplish that our board has to support and our employees have to believe is of value in order to support those investments of time and research and resources?
I love you talking about sort of the room with all the tools. So we have several of those around NASA, and they are I mean, it's so awesome to like visit and just like be in the room. Like, it's like, oh, it's five people from five different fields. And there's one, we had a sign up, and one of them is like a prototype is worth 1,000 meetings. Mm-hmm. And that has stuck with me. I was like, yes, like that's such an innovator's way of thinking. So it's so great to hear that that is an approach elsewhere in the world and also in healthcare. You don't think about that as healthcare, mm-hmm. but clearly it's working.
Well, that's what's so cool about medical devices, right? So I think it's, again, an under-invested field, but medical devices are the thing that can be prototyped in healthcare. I'm really excited. We're opening a new building at NovaCure's U.S. headquarters in New Hampshire, and it's going to have a human factors lab, which is essentially like a rapid prototyping laboratory. The woman who heads that team is fascinating. And James, if you're ever in the area, would love to have you come and see that facility once it opens up later.
Can we have the NASA team visit? Because I think they would get a kick out of that.
Absolutely, yes. I would love it.
But also a network of multidisciplinary kind of perspectives and domains is also incredibly powerful. And it sounds like you're putting that to good use as well, right? So I heard machine shop, engineers, physicists, electronics, right? Human factors, right? So what are some of those other multidisciplinary kind of areas of expertise, or maybe some of the unexpected domains that you guys have in your network to help you think through kind of these solution pathways?
Yeah, what a great question. I think when I think about other companies that are doing really interesting things in healthcare, again, a lot of them are medical device companies because drugs are amazing, but they can only do, that's not fair. Drugs are amazing and they're different than medical devices, which have many different applications. I have former colleagues and friends working at companies that are trying to create a home hemodialysis machine. So you don't have to go in for dialysis anymore. An ability to do more complicated testing and scanning in the home as well, so that a patient doesn't have to go into a facility to be diagnosed or monitored for certain diseases. When you think about other treatments for diseases that could be created with a medical device, it's hard to even imagine what that looks like, right? Because it's not very common. But a former colleague of mine works at a company that has a device that treats restless leg syndrome. You've got devices for some of the really, we're seeing so many issues with mental health these days, and increasingly medical devices that could help people who have who face mental health challenges. Whether it's a light or some kind of brain
experiences and outcomes, right?
Right, so, exactly. Yeah, you've got folks working on products that can help people who have mental health issues as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like someone described to me as like a lot of drugs, a lot of sort of drugs that we take is like, yeah, it's even antidepressants, et cetera, like, it's like soup, right? Like it's, your brain is in a soup of chemicals and you hope it targets the thing that you want. And some diseases, some afflictions are generalized. And yes, having swimming in that is fine, but sometimes they are targeted. They're in one specific spot. And if you can find a way to get there, and it sounds like, I mean, with the glioblastomas that your company is dealing with, I mean, that is something that would be behind the brain blood barrier. So hard to get to with drugs.
Exactly.
And also in the middle of the brain. So also probably not something you want to do surgery on. So I mean, it sounds like, your approach is actually really great compared to its neighboring approaches because of the limits, the physical limits of the body and the dangers of inherent risk. So it's cool that there's exactly. It sounds like there is a good combination of device and drug delivery and all these other things. Because I think when people think about like medical devices, they think the wheelchair. Oh, it's a cane. Yes, it's a brace for my knee. And like that's such an outdated way of thinking about emerging tech. Yeah, that's so cool.
Exactly right. Yeah. And that's what I know I keep harping on payment systems, but when the Medicare program, which covers a lot of Americans, was created, we didn't have these kinds of really interesting devices. And as a result, the payment systems don't really exist for them. So I think that's been part of the challenge and why you haven't seen more of these ideas that people have had. Oh, do we have a robot that could perform surgeries? so much more perfectly than a human could, right? Where is it? It's not here yet. And in part because I think because the payment systems haven't created a pathway for that. I was able to participate in an event that a member of Congress held in Texas last year, and he convened a group of innovators who are working across the healthcare field, including what you would call, I think, systems delivery, making sure people could get access to care in different ways, maybe at home instead of in a facility, devices and other products. But the one I think besides ours that was the most interesting was a company that's doing something related to these sort of brain implants for paraplegics that would allow folks to control a product, right? And I know, like, it's in the news. We talk about the brain implants. There are other people doing it than the main one everybody's thinking about. And the technology's further along than I would have thought. You don't have to necessarily get the implant as deep into the brain when you're able to control something without speaking or touching it, right? And how incredible is that?
Yeah.
So I am so excited about the intersection there, because those folks obviously aren't just bringing in doctors, right? They've got people from across the spectrum working on the electronics and other parts of the innovation ecosystem. So it's going to be really exciting to see where we end up in the next few years.
It was, I think, one of the things I learned, because I was digging, I went down to the rabbit hole one evening on some of those sort of neural interfaces, and that one of the things, the tricks that we had to get around was the surgery was so like ethically challenging. It was like, well, like, we don't know if this works, but we're going to insert these things in your brain is a hard ask for any sort of ethical review board. But they found, I think, a population of people being treated with epilepsy who already had the implants. Say, great. Well, can we just like hook in and do some other tests? Can we try to find other technologies? So the ethical issues are deeply lessened. And then from that sort of early data set, we've now seen, I think someone was actually playing video games. They had the first, like, the YouTuber was in the first documented, like, Call of Duty kill via like a brain implant.
Oh my
control.
Gosh.
And I was like, this is, we're in the future now. This is awesome. But it opened my mind that, wow, there was an ecosystem of startups that were playing in the space, all based on this early data set that we had to creatively get to. But once it's there, now a lot of investment has been justified as, oh, well, we proved it out. Now we can go in. Now the ethics of actually having someone do the surgery for this device makes sense, right? We've crossed that bridge. And it is really exciting to see this growth. But you hit on something like the way you talked about sort of medical device funding. I mean, it sounds like Medicare or sort of Medicaid device profiling, I guess, from like the years ago. So were the laws sort of carved out thinking, oh, it's a wheelchair, oh, it's a cane, and that's how they've been funded. And now we're at this new ecosystem of like, well, actually it's cancer delivery devices or cancer treatment devices, delivery devices. Yes. And that now we have this issue where the laws around devices don't match the capabilities of today's system? Is that sort of where we're
absolutely
at?
Absolutely. I mean,
okay.
I think that I worked on healthcare on Capitol Hill for a decade, and there's so much that I do not understand about how we pay for, how we reimburse for this, devices included, but for different healthcare items and services, which is how the Medicare program calls them. It's done based on site of care. So there's a whole payment system if you're in the hospital. There's a whole payment system if you receive for the services you get from a physician. There's a whole payment system for Medicare Advantage plans, which are the private Medicare plans. And if you are a what's called durable medical equipment product, so yes, historically a cane, a wheelchair, a boot, a commode, that's paid in a certain way, but here our product is, and others like it, that are these really innovative, cutting edge, but home use products that are being paid through that payment system, durable medical equipment. So it's just not set up to work for products like ours. Absolutely. And then the healthcare payment system generally is so complicated when you think about a surgical implant, right? Is that going to get paid for in the current payment systems, the way it's set up today? I don't know, probably not, right? So what's the future for that? It's going to take some really interesting policymaking, I think, and some legislators who want to dig into the topic because it's so complicated.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I'm just listening to you reflecting on, again, I'm not as close to this system as both of you are, but I'm thinking about how powerful the voices of perhaps installed lobbies might be in influencing perceptions and the design of these systems, right? And entrepreneurs who are coming up with really game-changing solutions may have a kind of a diminutive voice in that landscape. So how can the entrepreneurial landscape, how can these really game-changing solutions and innovators have a balanced voice in this system so that the systems evolve in a way that they get the right solutions in play?
That's an amazing question. I think you're so right. I mean, when large companies have whole teams of dozens of people who can navigate these payment systems and help create and design products that will get reimbursed to meet the payment systems and then to manipulate the payment systems, right? And an innovator can hardly even begin to understand that when you're scrapping to make payroll, right? How do you have time to figure out if the Medicare Part B NTAP program, Part A NTAP program will give me a bonus for this in months where I do this? I mean, it's just not feasible. So it's expensive also to understand it and engage in it. And yeah, I mean, that regulatory complexity absolutely benefits people who are already in the market and operating. So it's hard to break through. Working with a trade association that represents small companies is one way that's less expensive to be able to get in and get information and potentially impact the system. But I think that today, the power, again, of narratives and of being able to tell that story is so critically important that that's the main way that I think folks can break through.
It is. It is. Yeah. It's such a, I think people underestimate the size of some of the players in the healthcare space. The last company I was at before joining NASA, I mean, I think my first day, someone said, it's like, oh, like there were six acquisitions just within our little part of healthcare data processing. Six big acquisitions last year, where the little fish, the one that got acquired, was doing like over $1 billion in revenue.
Yes.
I was like, those are the little fish.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, wow, we're talking about a scale of size and complexity that is just as, I mean, like, I was coming from startups like, oh man, we raised $4 million. We're so happy. Mm-hmm. And they talk about like, we're competing against $1 billion revenue. And those are also startups in, yes, in the healthcare space was just mind blowing to me. And I think trying to play in that ecosystem from a policy or from a sort of lobbying and getting your point across, trying to get your patients to even get the meeting to talk about your solutions is so hard. So, I mean, thank you for fighting the good fight for trying to get this innovation ecosystem. But yeah, it is really hard.
Well, it's a joy. I mean, I feel, again, lucky to work at a company that I think our revenue is $500 million a year, and we're like a teeny tiny little speck on the map. But the leadership at this company is really invested in and understands the value of this kind of engagement. So that's why I have a job, right? But a lot of companies of our size don't, because it's tough. So thank you for saying that. It's a real joy. I love getting to do what I do.
Yeah, no, it's so important. Your perspective, your experience is, I'm sure, uniquely helpful. You understand both the public and the private landscape and how that comes together in such an important sector. So, thank you for the work that you're doing. I'll echo James' sentiment. And if we maybe distill this into a few points of advice for other entrepreneurs and businesses that are trying to lead change and heavily entrenched or very mature sectors, any advice that you might have for organizations that are trying to navigate basically highly regulated landscapes in introducing new technology, new innovation in order to make a real change in the path forward? Recommendations?
I think it's important to be in Washington, D.C., which is a tough message, but to be here and to be able to build relationships with the folks who are making policy, even if it's one or two, right? If you can find a champion who cares about what you're trying to accomplish to raise the profile of your issue, that can make all the difference in the world. So I do really encourage engagement in Washington and the policymaking process and knowing what's going on here. And because what government's doing is setting up those incentives, right? right? And that'll impact the whole industry.
Yeah, so important. I think that systems level awareness and design and navigation is going to be so important, right? As the pace and amplitude of change continues to increase, I think that understanding of the landscape is going to be so critical, right? Incentives, interactions, and the flow of information. James, your thoughts, key takeaways from your perspective?
Yeah, I guess pull on a few threads from this conversation and sort of pulling together in my mind is that one, we talked about earlier about this idea of narratives being so effective. And like I knew that, I had experienced that, but I hadn't actually thought of that from the context of like narratives for startups in sort of social impact or policy related fields. And being in DC, as you just said, Katie's like, well, that actually, there is actually power there. Even when I was working in the cybersecurity space, we had narratives that we sold to banks. We're like, oh, imagine if this happens. But we weren't necessarily talking to policymakers about, well, like, we actually want the ecosystem to change. And we've been going this by trying to get customers who will then pressure you. But the reality is that, hey, some of these regulations are 15 years old, and that is ancient in cybersecurity terms. You know, if you change this, our business grows, but also the US gets safer, our banks get safer, our granny and grandpa's bank accounts get safer. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't actually split that together, is that there might be some value to having those narratives, startups having narratives that aren't just for customers, but are for regulators, that they could easily share that in a policymaking perspective. But that's thank you for sort of like being part of this conversation, because I think that's two threads I had not tied together before. So that'll be stuck in my mind for a few weeks, I'm sure. Diane, how about you?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, startups are in small businesses, right? In these very intensive sectors are certainly, they're trying to solve for the rules at play, right? And the landscape of the rules that exist. But to both of your points, there is so much opportunity for them to paint the picture of what is possible and perhaps influence how the landscape of rules evolve, right? The landscape of governance evolves. And that's really important, right? To shape a better path forward, not just solving for the rules that exist, but also perhaps having a conversation about how that needs to adjust in order to unlock greater potential, greater benefit for society as a whole. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up. And Katie, thank you so much. This has been a brilliant conversation. We're grateful for you. We're grateful for the work that you guys are doing that there at NovaCure. And we hope to come back to you and continue the conversation.
What an absolute pleasure. And yeah, I hope that we get to have a field trip up to our New Hampshire Human Factors Lab. So I look forward to that. Thank you, guys.
Likewise. Thank you. And for our listeners, thank you again for tuning in to another Ecosystemic Futures brought to you by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project and in collaboration with Shoshaworks. If you enjoyed this, please join us and subscribe. And you can always find more at shoshaworks.com. Thanks again, and we'll talk soon.